Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm going to be talking to Kai Hanno-Schwindt, who is an associate professor in the School of Arts, Design and Media at Christiana University College, and Simone Knox, who's an associate professor of film and television at the University of Reading, about their new book, Friends, A Reading of the Sitcom, which is published by Palgrave. So welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Hello. Thanks for having us.
This is a first, a podcast double act recorded across Europe, which I'm really hopeful it works. It's going well so far by the looks of it. This is a wonderful book. It's both on a kind of personal level. I'm old enough to have grown up watching this sitcom and seeing it treated, I guess, really very seriously, but also in, you know, a kind of an accessible and quite knowing way is really great. And it prompts me, I guess, to start with why you decided to write the book, actually, and how the writing partnership developed.
Do you want to talk about that? How did we get together, Simone? I actually don't remember that
when we first had the idea. We met up in 2013 in London, walking along the South Bank. And then we were talking about, you know, film and television that we are interested in. And we talked about how we both are so interested in Friends, how it's such a seminal program. And then we said, there's no book. And then we said, do you know what? If there's still no book, by the time we come to the 25-year anniversary, we'll be the ones who will write this book.
Exactly. I remember now. Yeah, that's how it all started. Yeah. That was that. And then the other thing, of course, was, that 25th anniversary that was coming along. But it was also a weird sort of mix of three things. First of all, the realization that there was so little academic writing and scholarship on Friends. There's so much on sitcom. There's so much on all kinds of television. But somehow, not very much on Friends. There are some odd, you know, articles here and there focusing on some aspects, but not the sort of holistic approach to the whole series, which we thought, okay, that's what it deserves. Then you've got all that, you know, the hype and the success stories and all the articles, you know, as we were leading up to the 25th anniversary, that then somehow met that weird backlash towards the series, which we've seen emerging, maybe sort of already 10 years ago, first and foremost coming from the United States and the sort of cultural journalism prevalent there. Everything that was allegedly problematic with the series, you know, it's homophobic, it's transphobic, there's fat shaming, all of this stuff, which we thought, there are a lot of interesting leads there to explore. But we felt, okay, that it's sort of it goes a bit into different directions. And we thought that was one of the impulses to wrap that all up and to weave it together and to start writing the book.
Yeah, and we were in a way waiting to see, because we thought surely somebody will write that academic book on Friends in the meantime, because we were doing other stuff at the time. But then, you know, sort of time went on, and then we thought, okay, we'll put a proposal in and we'll write it then.
I might sort of follow up on that actually, Simone, with like, this sounds like a really stupid question for people of a certain age, but I suppose more globally, why did Friends need an academic book? Like, what is it about this show that makes it matter?
Well, I think it needed an academic book because it needed that serious in-depth treatment that you've already referred to there in passing. And it deserves that serious academic in-depth treatment because it's one of the most significant TV shows in the history of television, possibly the most significant. If you look at the commercial success, if you look at the critical success, it's long surpassed being a TV show as such. It's a cultural phenomenon. It's influenced the English language. It's influenced fashion, with the Rachel hairdo, for example. It's become this huge franchise that includes this annual or now biannual interactive touring exhibition. There's pop-up or not even pop-up cafes all over the world that emulate the look of the coffee shop in the show. It's just become this cultural phenomenon that far transcends being a TV show. And that was both very attractive for writing about it, but also a real challenge because as we were writing the book, as we were coming up to the 25-year anniversary, it was just constantly in the news, you know, the social media engagement about the show. There's not just, you know, a good bunch of fan groups, for example, on Instagram or Facebook that post about it once in a while. They post about it several times per hour to this day, 25 years later. So it was a real challenge in a way to keep on top of that because there was just so much that we could have done. But ultimately, we thought what's still missing is actually the analysis of the show itself. So that's what we decided to do, and that's where we placed our emphasis.
I mean, that's precisely what we can do with the podcast, I think. And the place to start is really obviously what makes it funny and how is it, I guess, you know, sort of related to a much larger story about the kind of canon of sitcoms, particularly actually what it does in unique ways and where it relates to things that had gone before. And I suppose this is your sort of specialist subject, Kai, but one way into that might be actually talking about the characters, because one of the things you do in the book which works really well, I think, is use each character to talk about how theories of humor and kind of comic types work.
Yeah, that's right. And just going back a little bit, because I actually thought that's a very good way of phrasing it, you know, that what makes it funny, which is this sort of banal and simple question that somehow very few scholars before bothered to ask. And that was one of the things, you know, when we were talking about why does this deserve a holistic analysis, the humor played an important part there, because there are some references here and there to different aspects of the show's humor, very superficially referring to irony, the irony in Friends or something like that. And we thought, okay, no, this is so much more nuanced, and there's got to be somehow of a recipe and an approach there that Friends, the show, succeeded in, that led to that huge success, that global success. So this was very interesting to approach it. And it's exactly like you said, we started with a sort of a typology of all these characters, because of course that's one of our main claims. This is a group show. It's about these six characters that enables the sort of the comedic trajectory that the show has to touch on very different types of humor and humorous areas. I'm not sure if we have the time to go through all of them, but if we, for example, have a look at Chandler, which is a character that, especially in the beginning of the show, connected a lot with with audiences, probably also because he might be the most ironic character. And in the 90s, you know, that postmodern irony age, that was probably had a huge impact on audiences. But he stands for that, for the sarcasm, you know, the sarcastic comments that he has on everything around him. He's the commentator of the group. But there's also a self-deprecating irony that he puts forth that makes that a very successful comedic vehicle for a particular type of humor, which is then coupled up with completely different areas of comedy. For instance, in Phoebe, who represents a more absurdist and surreal approach, and that sort of literally thinking outside of the box, which is how her character is described, is also visible in her humor. And this is what we do in the book. We go through all six of them and we attach different types of humorous discourses, different types of humorous comedic traditions that are then woven together in that group dynamic. And this is the other realization, which is so interesting to observe in Friends, is that, yes, you have these individual types of humor, but you also have a group humor. There's a group dynamic in that humor that the show draws from almost exclusively from season two onwards. They tried in the first two seasons to base the humor a bit more on these sort of pop cultural references, things that were happening in the United States in the 90s, but then decided, like Marta Kaufman, one of the series creators that we interviewed, said, we realized what you want is the six of them in the room. And this is exactly what also is visible in the humor and in the comedic sensibility that the show has.
It's good you mentioned in the room, and I think we're going to come back to spaces. Simone mentioned the kind of the iconic nature of spaces and the, you know, the pop-up cafes that have followed Central Perk and stuff like this. But before that, it might be good, Kai, if you could say a little bit maybe about the format, or maybe this is more Simone's specialty, because as well as the kind of the question of humor and comedy, there's also, I think, some important work in the book around the format, both in terms of that kind of multi-actor, multi-camera approach, but also in terms of the dynamics of the cast together in a sitcom format.
Do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I would just say that this kind of links to the idea of genre and how Friends fits into the genre of sitcom and multi-camera sitcom in particular. And I think one thing that's very easy to forget about Friends is actually how innovative and interesting it has been. What a contribution it has made to the genre, because it's so successful now and it has spawned so many, I don't want to say copycats, but copycats over the years, that it's actually really easy to not really fully see how innovative it actually was. And one of the really innovative things about Friends and the really strong, you know, one of its main strengths is that it is genuinely committed to its six main characters almost equally, I think we would say, and that it explores that through the storytelling, it explores that through performance and how the characters work and that, you know, how their relationships work. Yes, of course, some storylines ultimately were very much at the core of the storytelling project, like Ross and Rachel, for example. But the show is genuinely interested in all of its six main characters. And I think that is one of the things that it has given to sitcom and multi-camera sitcom, and also investing it with a commitment to seriousness and to feeling and to emotion in a way that, you know, isn't the most readily associated with multi-camera sitcoms, certainly until Friends came along. And that was something we found very much as well in the interviews we undertook with a number of the key creative personnel, like Marta Kaufman and Kevin S. Bright, for example, that real commitment to the humor and the comedy that Kai's already spoken to, but also to the drama and to the core emotional relationship within the show that is clearly very important to what makes Friends the enduring success that it has become.
And just to follow up on that, what you already mentioned is that aspect about the performance, which we pay a great deal of attention to, because it's very easily that multi-sitcom performance gets dismissed as a bit more, you know, farcical, superficial, classical, vaudeville type of performance, which is basically about delivering the punchlines and not getting in the way of the script and that scripted sort of comedy. But what we found is that in particular in Friends, and the show also has been a sort of a blueprint for other sitcoms to follow, is that what we call holistic performance that the cast is so excellent in presenting, because it's not just about delivering those punchlines, which actually is difficult enough for comedic actors, but it's also about basing these characters in a certain kind of naturalism, so that we as an audience can still believe what is going on. You know, the Ross and Rachel storyline, that's one thing, but you actually have to sell this. And it was very interesting for us also to go back into a very detailed scene analysis and look at how exactly these actors facilitate that type of holistic performance, which sort of oscillates between a more sort of comedic punchline delivery, where you have to pay a lot of attention to that multi-camera live situation. You know, how, for example, do you deliver a punchline which is followed by a laugh, how you then have to stay in character and continue with the performance, which then meets also these more silent, more quiet, and more naturalistic type of performances, which is very interesting to see how these characters and these actors, pull that off. And I don't think that they have gotten enough credit for that. Of course, everybody acknowledges that these are sort of iconic characters filled out by these actors. But it was very interesting to look closer into that process, which also, I think, contributes to the success that Friends has had around the world.
Yeah, and there's a really nice, actually, analysis in the book of some high-profile, extremely talented guest star actors who don't quite work in the context of the demands both of the genre but also the dynamics of that core set of Friends. I just want to pick up something that Simone had said about the kind of sense of emotion that has sustained both, you know, the kind of fandom but also was important to the writers. I was struck, I think was Seinfeld's like kind of core line was no hugging, no learning for any of the four core characters in the show. And it is such a contrast with Friends. And one of the things that the book does, I think both in one of the chapters that talks about the space of the set, but also actually throughout the book, is try and foreground these questions of emotion, intimacy, and the sense of these, you know, having exactly as Kai said, you know, something more than just a life that's about delivering punchlines and making the audience laugh. And the obvious way to discuss this is Monica's apartment, which I think Simone, you know, we now see as one of these kind of really iconic, great spaces in the history of television that's, you know, instantly sort of recognizable, and yet is also a stage for a really important understanding of how intimacy works on the show.
Absolutely. I mean, this was one of the, in terms of the critical framework for the book, you know, we kept thinking, what is it about this show? Why this show out of all the shows that are out there? Why has this engendered such an intense, committed viewership across so many viewers of different age groups, demographics, across the very different parts of the world? And we started formulating this In relation to, first, actually, we were thinking along the lines of Raymond Williams' notion of the structure of feeling, but we actually then shifted towards framing it more explicitly as a deliberate strategy, however consciously intended or not by the production team. But we found that helped to encapsulate and capture that interest in by the show in producing these feelings of warmth, of attachment, of emotional commitment to, you know, what is a multi-camera show. And it really, really is reflected in particularly Monica's Apartment, as you mentioned there, because Monica's Apartment, it has become the most iconic TV set probably of all time. It's become the key point of reference within the creative industries itself in terms of successful set design. And that sense of intimacy really shows itself in the fact that the team working on this, which would have involved Kevin Bright, but also John Schaffner, the wonderful production designer and set decorators and prop people, etc. They took a very deliberate approach to not making it look, as much as that is possible, like a stage where actors come and go and have to deliver their punchlines. They've invested it with a lot of detail. Much of which actually I couldn't notice really properly in the 1990s watching it on a then below average TV set. But it really stands up to repeated scrutiny with, digital technology over the years. So there's a lot of interest in adding detail, in managing that detail very carefully. So, you know, elements of the set design, like, you know, scatter cushions and throws and, you know, plants, etc., they do get changed like they would in a, you know, real living space, but not too much because it is iconic and it is a familiar space that audiences enjoy returning to again and again. And through the use of color, through the use of lighting, through the use of a lot of texture, this feeling of intimacy and warmth is achieved. If you look particularly at the color purple on the wall, the iconic purple, initially on the model box that John Schaffner designed for the show, the color on the walls was white. And then in the discussion with Kevin Bright, they decided that, no, they wanted it to look different from other shows. They wanted it to be eye-catching. And the purple that they chose works very well. So John Schaffner told us, works really well for the human skin tone, white skin tones, obviously, as it's a white cast show, and is something that registers well on a screen. And then the lighting, they very deliberately use not this sort of the flat, indiscriminate sort of approach to lighting that is often associated with a multi-camera sitcom, but which Kevin Bright in particular wanted to move against. So the lighting is much more modulated. There's a lot of practical. So you see a lot of the light sources on the screen, lots of sconces, lots of table lamps. It just gives this very cozy atmosphere to the show. And a lot of different textures. So we have exposed brick wall in the kitchen. We've got lots of fabrics of different kinds. We've got the floors. We've got the walls. We've got plants. We have a lot of texture for the eye. And ultimately, it creates this really inviting space that then, through repeated exposure over the episodes and seasons, has become so very iconic for the show, and in which a lot of the key storytelling, of course, a lot of the key storylines occur within the show. A lot of it happens in that space.
I guess you've also touched on what we might think of as like the problem with Friends. And I guess Monica's Apartment is quite a nice segue, really, because some of the, if we might think of like the kind of the economic backlash in Friends was around the idea of, hang on, how do they afford to live in these kinds of places doing the jobs they do in, you know, downtown New York, even in the much cheaper 1990s? And that is a route into a whole range of, backlash against the show Simone, you also mentioned, you know, the predominantly white cast, and actually race in the show is a really serious problem and site for struggle. So it'd be interesting to pick up on, I guess, the kind of the backlash, and we can do that in lots of different ways, but perhaps Kai, you might be able to talk about this question of race and representation on the show.
This was a bit more on Simone took the lead, so she could maybe explore this a bit further. Maybe just as a little setup to that, because you're absolutely right that this is has been incredibly interesting to explore Friends based on that, because that type of backlash, in a way, and we can discuss if backlash is the right word here as well, started already in the 90s. The show was criticized for that, you know, all too white cast, which seemed odd if you base a show in New York City, in Manhattan, a melting pot. And the producers in the interviews with us already mentions that they were aware of this, even though it was based on their personal experience. Marta Kaufman and David Crane modeled the Friends cast on their personal friendship and experiences, so there was some sort of autobiographical approach to this. But they realized eventually more representation, a diverse representation, was in order. But just before Simone elaborates on that, another aspect that I found very interesting is that sort of retrofitted glance that we have on the show. Also, in terms of sexuality, a huge aspect of the backlash was directed towards the alleged transphobia of the character of Chandler's dad, who in the show is this weird mix of a gay man played by a woman, by Kathleen Turner, also some sort of a transvestite character. It's very messy. And with our view on that today, absolutely problematic. But here the creators of the show said also, yes, we know we couldn't have done that today, and we wouldn't also. We just weren't aware of that at the time. And this is something that we have to, in a way, acknowledge today. And this was interesting for us also writing this in 2019, looking back at this, where we realized, okay, this is, why can't we take this as part of the discourse about Friends? There are obviously problematic elements here. But this is also something that tells you something about that time and how far we've come. Which is very interesting and sometimes in itself not very permitted opinion if you're facing the discourses of woke and political correctness in particular from the United States, which made writing about those topics very interesting, and we also decided to tread very carefully and give this, you know, a lot of scrutiny to really get to the bottom of this. And this is maybe your cue, Simone, to talk a bit more about these.
Yes, very interesting, a challenge it was indeed. I mean, I think, you know, Kai, you've set this up really nicely, because you mentioned earlier already that there's so many failings that that have been labeled or thrown at the show, all the isms, all the ways in which it's ideologically suspect, shall we say. And I would say that the issues concerning, you know, the absolute, is the whiteness of the core cast, I think the issues around race are probably the single biggest ideological shortcoming of this program. Yes, it's understandable. If you think about context, we do highlight the importance of context and historical context in the book. Yes, at the time in the 90s, network TV shows tended to be pretty much a white core cast. And then non-network shows might have a black core cast. You know, that was at the time the sort of the landscape. But certainly the fact that the show became so successful for NBC After each season, it just kept on building and building and building. And there could have been and should have been more investment into bringing in more diversity, even with the core cast in place. And this is actually something that Kevin Bright also said to us in our interview with him. He said, even, you know, once you have those six actors in place, and indeed today it's very difficult to imagine Friends with different actors cast in the roles, not that other actors couldn't have done an excellent job, but even with those six core actors in place, there could have been more diversity introduced in the show. And Friends only really moved towards that in any more meaningful way at the end of season 9 and in early season 10, when Aisha Tyler, she joined the Friends cast for, I want to say, 9 episodes or so in total. She joined it for a few episodes. And that was the most sustained high profile in terms of just the significance of the role, a presence of an actor of color on the show. And I do think they actually, you know, handled that quite interestingly. So Aisha Tyler has spoken about how it was an open audition call. They weren't looking for specifically an actor of color, but then they cast an actor of color for this part. And that leads to some really interesting moments whereby you see a woman of color in 1990s or early noughties New York experiencing a range of situations and encounters, some of which are ideologically more palatable to us nowadays, I would think, and some of which also at the same time reveal a certain blindness, I guess, perhaps, on behalf of the production team, of the writing team. The production team of Friends was quite white. So there are some references in relation to Charlie Wheeler, that's the name of the character. There's some references to her hair that do really link up to notions around, well, you know, it's just ideologically quite difficult to experience some of that today. But we do highlight, as I mentioned, the importance of context. And also we highlight the importance of tone in our analysis, because even though sometimes, you know, some of the scripting is clumsy at best, shall we say, sometimes, there is, you know, you can't make blanket sort of accusations about how, for example, Aisha Tyler's performance, you know, how her appearance was handled within the program. Because if you actually undertake that in-depth analysis of different scenes, you see that who we are encouraged to laugh at and who we are encouraged to laugh with, those are really important questions, and they come around, they come about through a number of different factors. In the case of Charlie Wheeler, particularly Aisha Tyler's performance, which does invest that character with quite a lot of comedic agency that undercuts and runs counter to some of the problematic aspects of the script writing, I would say.
I mean, there's so much we could talk about on this. And I think part of the story of the backlash, and then, you know, in some ways, the kind of defense of the backlash is, as you mentioned, you know, Friends tells us something about the attitudes in the mid-1990s. The story of how we discuss Friends now tells us something about where we are now in terms of the kind of the deployment of particular cultural objects, cultural artifacts to kind of score points in, you know, what is very much a sort of contemporary American culture war. I guess the other thing, you know, that we really haven't touched on, and we might do this very briefly, is the sense that actually this isn't just an American show. And, you know, as much as it's a story of six New Yorkers and is a story, you know, that is almost entirely focused on the States, it's got this incredible global reputation, not just in terms of its fandom, but also in terms of the book talks about, you know, kind of almost direct copies that have been made in Iran and in China, and, you know, this kind of global influence. So I guess as a kind of point of conclusion, maybe Kai, you could kind of say a little bit about the global reception of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. That was also very interesting to take a closer look at that sort of, as we call it, the universality of friends, which is in that sort of first sort of superficial approach. Yeah, okay, he is that huge American show that sort of in the same vein of many other, you know, American global imperialist culture is sort of swept around the globe, and Friends also made its impact there. But if you look at it more closely, there are elements there that are very interesting to trace how that show has connected around the world. And without going into great many details here, it is again that sort of strategy of intimacy that the show executes that helped it to connect with diverse audiences, as you know, as they can be, from Iran via China to Egypt, which were the cases we looked at a bit more closer. Also, which was interesting, that a lot of interviews and respondents that were asked about the success and the appeal of Friends in those countries, in particular in Egypt, I remember now, said that here in that show there are friendly Americans. These are friendly Americans that sort of counteract that image that in particular Middle Eastern countries was sort of propagated about the United States, which I thought was an interesting a twist on the whole thing. And then in general, which we also scrutinize a bit more, is how does a show like that travel around the world, and what other sort of also industrial context does that meet? For instance, in the country where I'm from, Germany, where Friends had a bit more problematic start because of the German dubbing. Germany dubs all of its programs on television and in the cinemas, and so also Friends, and usually to a high level of expertise. I know that German dubbing is ridiculed around the world. But if you take a close look and you realize that a lot of work goes into that, and the whole process has been perfectionized. But with Friends, they sort of dropped the ball, and they somehow misunderstood the comedic sensibility and the comedic tonality of the show. And there were problems with the voice casting, and that was also very interesting to take a closer look at, in a way to sort of summarize also what the show still means around the world, and how those cultural products travel around the world, which is also something that didn't receive that much scholarly attention so far.
There's so much more we could discuss it. You know, we really have just sort of scratched the surface of the book, and it seems a bit mean, actually, to kind of to wrap up with a question about what you're working on next. But that point you make about, you know, the kind of the potential for scholarly attention, either if you're going to be doing more work on Friends, you know, maybe thinking about actually reception, political economy of production, or are you both, you know, quite happy to let the book go and maybe come back to it again in 25 years?
Well, we have already discussed, we already discussed during the writing of the book a couple of follow-up ideas that we could do. Some of the things that didn't quite fit into the book because of, you know, there's only so many, I mean, it's already 86,000 words without bibliographies. So we have some ideas for things, particularly, I think, in relation about representation that we're interested in coming back to. And also, I would say during the writing of the book on the show, we also realized some of the challenges that working on such a long running show with so much textual material, the kind of challenges that poses to you as the researcher, you know, who has a limited capacity for tracking certain kinds of information around, say, for example, performance or the use of space. So we're already at the moment in sort of very, very early discussions about potentially developing that and thinking about what methodologies we need to develop to be able to engage with such a big, you know, beast like Friends as a show is. Anything you want to add to that, Kai?
No, absolutely. And then also all these, you know, all these aspects that we somehow treat like footnotes in the book. One, for example, that I was just mentioning is dubbing cultures around the world. You know, how these global cultural products meet those local cultures and what that means, and how these artifacts are somehow transformed by those processes is something that I found incredibly interesting. Because what we tend to forget is that most people around the world all probably hear and perceive these shows that are so familiar to the English speaking world in with different voices and different meanings in a way sometimes. And I think that is something that I really want to explore more, which I'm sure we will be doing at some point.
I'm sure we will be.